بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. I'm going to start in a possibly unexpected place by looking at one of the founders of the French feminist movement at the turn of the last century, an individual by the name of Valentine de Saint-Point, 1875 to 1953. There's a new biography, incidentally, if you want the details of her life, by Véronique de la Fuente. The life is, as one would expect, well documented, except for reasons which I'll shortly explain, the closing years of her life. She's from a distinguished family. Her great uncle is the philosopher Lamartine, who she regards as a kind of inspiration for the remainder of her life. She goes to Paris from her native Masson and immediately throws herself into the Belle Époque world of wine, women, men and song, very much regarded as an Amazon, Bacchante as she was referred to, somebody who was a party girl, but a party girl with a mission. Liberated, flagrant, experimenting with everything that was available, one of the muses and also one of the mistresses of Rodin, a friend of Apollinaire and a number of avant-garde poets at the time, a typical French avant-garde intellectual. So far so predictable. She's a society beauty, she's from a good family, but certainly the thing she's not interested in is anything like organized religion. In fact, in keeping with many of her French Republican generation, she was more or less phobic towards it. But this is a time of transition in France. I can't, I'm afraid. I've been lecturing all day. I have another talk after this, so I'm kind of monitoring my volume levels carefully. This is the turn of the century. The naughty 90s are behind everybody, and looking forward to the 20th century is a time for most people of tremendous excitement and anticipation. 1900, we have the Exposition Universelle, which is a kind of great flamboyant French gesture towards the march of progress, and in it, in Paris, there is a Salle de la Femme, a hall of women, in which visitors could see the latest ideas about the status of women and the due relation between the genders. And it was an interesting kind of clash between two centuries. On the one hand, there was certainly the sense amongst many people, probably most at the time, and by no means just religionists, that the appropriate place for the woman was a dutiful submission at home. But this was also the beginning of the French suffragette movement. Many French women were campaigning for the vote and beyond. French women were just starting to be elected to the French Parliament. And so one also detects in that pavilion a sense that something is about to change and that an unimaginable transformation in society is breathlessly waiting to happen. Valentine is very much on the side of progress. And in the course of the next couple of decades, she traces a career for herself as a poet. She publishes several volumes of poetry, as a dancer, and as a choreographer, as an artist, particularly known for her woodcuts, and also as one of France's first feminist thinkers. But her feminism is of an unusual kind. This is before feminism even begins to be a coherent movement with its own styles of interpretation, its own standard text, its own list of legitimate agendas and aspirations. Everything is being remade in the white-hot furnace of France's new secular modernity. She's a member of the Futurist movement. The Futurists are those who are iconoclastically committed to burning the libraries, destroying the works of art in the Louvre, getting rid of the old stale bourgeois academicism and moving towards a new future. Some of them are inclined towards Bolshevism, others more patriotic and looking for forms of maintaining a specifically national or even racial narrative in the new brave scientific dawn. She's very much at the vanguard of that movement, and the most significant futurist thinker who is also involved actively with women's issues. Some of the futurists believe that the nature of woman, as defined by science, has to be primarily reproductive. There was a strong Darwinian sense that the nature of woman is to maximize the perpetuation of what the professor for the popular understanding of science, not a million miles from here, would regard as the selfish gene. We are just biology. This is about survival through war, through sexuality, through establishing the survival of the fittest. It's quite Nietzschean. But of course, the Marxists are also thinking along broadly similar lines. And for those futurists, the role of the woman was necessarily what it had always been, was a subordinate one, auxiliary, the helpmeet. So F.T. Marinetti, who's one of the leaders of the futurist movement, writes a manifesto, the founding manifesto of futurism. This is what he says. We will glorify war, the world's only hygiene, militarism, patriotism, the destructive gesture of freedom bringers, beautiful ideas worth dying for, and scorn for woman. Valentine de Saint-Point objects to this, and she writes her own counter-manifesto, the Manifesto of Futurist Women, which is to this day revered by people like Luce Irigaray and other French feminists as one of the key iconic documents of the founding age of French feminism. And this is the kind of thing she says. I'll just translate a few selected highlights. The fecund periods when the most heroes and geniuses come forth from the terrain of culture in all its ebullience are rich in masculinity and femininity. Those periods that had only wars with few representative heroes because the epic breath flattened them out were exclusively virile periods. Those that denied the heroic instinct and turning towards the past annihilated themselves in dreams of peace were periods in which femininity was dominant. We are living at the end of one of these periods. What is most lacking in women, as in men, is virility. That is why futurism, even with all its exaggerations, is right. So she starts by apparently supporting Marinetti's thesis. She says history is not so much about men and women, it's about two eternal principles, masculinity and femininity, which, as most people at the time thought, were actually scientifically established essences. Now, what do they do? What is the natural function of the genders? The spiritual inspirer, woman, the carnal inspirer, immolates or takes care, causes blood to run or staunches it, is a warrior or a nurse. It's the same woman who, in the same period, according to the ambient ideas grouped around the day's event, lies down on the tracks to keep the soldiers from leaving for the war, or then rushes to embrace the victorious champion. That is why no revolution should be without her. That is why, instead of scorning her, we should address her. She is the most fruitful conquest of all, the most enthusiastic, who, in her turn, will increase our followers. But not feminism. Feminism is a political error. Feminism is a cerebral error of woman, an error that her instinct will recognize. We must not give woman any of the rights claimed by feminists. To grant them to her would bring about not any of the disorders the futurists desire, but on the contrary, an excess of order. And that's where she really takes, from the perspective of present-day feminism, an essentialist wrong turn. She is insistent that, at least through the feminine principle, womanhood is essential to the revolutionary order, that whenever there is greatness in human history, there must be the nurturing principle of womanhood as well as the assertive, dominant principle of virility. So she scorns Marinetti's more or less Taliban-like erasure of women and the female principle. But what she's not saying is that this is going to be about rights and about an equating of the sexes. Throughout her career, she argues very strongly against that. For her, that would be to subordinate women to a set of priorities that have been established by men according to a particular virile sense of what human fulfillment should constitute. She's looking for a liberation. She's certainly anti-bourgeois. She's revolutionary. She's against the established order. She's sexually liberated. She's exploring all of the new arts that are iconoclastically throwing down for idols of the past. But she's doing it in the name of what she takes to be a female, feminine essence, which is what she wants to liberate, which has nothing to do with simply becoming replicas of the man. A year later, she publishes another manifesto. It's basically these two documents that she's remembered for, and if you Google her up on the internet, this is what will come up more frequently than her poems or her art. 1913, Manifeste de la Luxure, the futurist manifesto of lust, no less. Here again, she's very much part of the French avant-garde. This is Baudelaire, this is Apollinaire, this is the new art, this is the celebration of the discovery of the body as the most appropriate way of celebrating the collapse of traditional Catholicism. And of course, in the background, there are people like Freud, Adler, Melanie Klein, and a whole army of psychoanalytic thinkers who are proposing, again in this quasi-Darwinian way, that essentially the basic motivation of human beings is eros. And for her, we suffocate that at the price of our humanity. Lust is the expression of a being projected beyond itself. It is the painful joy of wounded flesh, the joyous pain of a flowering. And whatever secrets unite these beings, it is a union of flesh. It is the sensory and sensual synthesis that leads to the greatest liberation of spirit. It is the communion of a particle of humanity with all the sensuality of the earth. Art and war are the great manifestations of sensuality. Lust is their flower. Are people exclusively spiritual or are people exclusively carnal will be condemned to the same decadence, sterility. Christian morality alone, following on from pagan morality, was fatally drawn to consider lust as a weakness. Out of the healthy joy which is the flowering of the flesh in all its power, it has made something shameful and to be hidden, a vice to be denied. It has covered it with hypocrisy, and this has made a sin of it. We must strip lust of all the sentimental veils that disfigure it. These veils were thrown over it out of mere cowardice, because smug sentimentality is so satisfying. Sentimentality is comfortable and, therefore, demeaning. Well, you can imagine that these manifestos, which were printed and reprinted, were quite a sensation in left bank avant-garde Paris at the time. And it's also quite easy to see how they fit in, at least with the cutting a wave of a certain type of war against what was understood to be traditional Christianity. She is not interested in having a job. She is not interested in earning a living. She has her own emolument from her family. She inherits. She marries twice, divorces twice. And she holds court in a very French Parisian environment of a salon in her home in the 16th arrondissement, and everybody goes, not just Apollinaire and Rodin, but the people who are then going to move into the Dada movement, Braque goes along, and so on. In this context, she publishes her poems, Poèmes de la mer et du soleil, Les poèmes d'orgueil, and so forth. And then the critical thing happens. Like a lot of people in her time, she becomes interested in something called Mediterraneanism, an ungainly word. We've never really had anything quite like that in English. Mediterraneanism comes from the particular French sense of being pulled between two poles, the north and the south. Now, the French, the descendants of the Germanic Franks, and therefore connected to Northern Europe's linear narrative of progress and science and self-possession, the stiff upper lip, is that what has made France great in her imperial and scientific accomplishments? Or alternatively, is France Latin? Is it of the south? Is it truly Mediterranean? Warm, languorous, hospitable, inefficient, but spiritual. And she always uses the word spiritual in the vaguest possible sense. She comes to the view that actually the correct way of breaking with the deadening machine age is to turn towards the Mediterranean, turn towards the sun, which is hence all of these poems that she's writing about the sun. The sun for her, as for many others, is a symbol of light and of warmth. The more you move away from it, the more you come into the spiritual, artistic, human death of Northern Europe, with its negation of virility and femininity, its negation of authentic humanity. Like many other people who are thinking along the same lines, she decides to experience this, le soleil, for herself, and she goes to Morocco. And you think of all the others who went to North Africa, Gide, who went to Biskra, Isabel Eberhardt, who went just about everywhere, various writers before or since who went to Morocco, Matisse. She goes to Morocco with a friend of hers and tours the south, where she finds, to her great excitement, what she takes to be the actual lived experience that in her Paris arrondissement she has only been, in a utopian sense, dreaming about. Here she finds men who are truly men. Here she finds women who are truly women. Here she finds an authenticity, a genuine connection of earth and heaven, of tradition and the present, a genuine belongingness to the land, to the elements, to sexuality itself, that looks to her like what she's been looking for in Paris, but in the north was never able to find. It's an extraordinary transformation for her. What happens next is the First World War, and this is really the great watershed in her life. At the outset, she's still a futurist. She believes in war, she believes in machinery, she thinks that this is the war that's going to destroy the old class system, that's going to destroy the ancient fossilized bourgeois conventions that are barring human beings from experiencing their authenticity. Of course, she's a woman, she can't join up, but she drives an ambulance and puts on a nurse's uniform, and for several years is involved in tending the wounded. The white-hot enthusiasm for the war of 1914, gradually after the Battle of the Marne and the horrors of the trenches, turns to a certain disillusionment in her and in her contemporaries, and an extraordinary crisis of futurist faith ensues. She's not sure what to do about the reality of the suffering that she is seeing all the time. The cripples on the streets of Paris, the economic catastrophe, the human misery, the disillusionment with the whole scientific patriotic project. So to run away from it, she goes first of all to Spain, where she stays with her friend Picabia, the artist. And then she goes off to America, where she makes a name for herself in the same sort of avant-garde artistic circles in New York. She has, as what she takes to be her supreme art form, something that she calls métagogie. Her view is that Western sensibility is academicized and has fragmented the human and artistic experience. Music is one discipline, theater is another discipline, dance is something else, poetry is something else, architecture is something else. That's emblematic of the fragmented condition of the Enlightenment mind. She wants to bring them all together, and this seems to be what she's up to with this idea of métagogie. And the Metropolitan Opera in New York is one of the places where she puts on these festivals. And she's a dancer, she herself performs. Her idea, as she expresses it, is to reintegrate the human personality to a triumphant affirmation of gender, sexuality, the body, with all of the other arts of music, chant, poetry. So the thing is a kind of festival of everything. There are images, there is dance, there is music. Everything is there on stage. The New York critics were sympathetic, but the audiences were a little baffled by this very avant-garde performance. She's a student of Diaghilev and Stravinsky, and New York is not quite there yet. But she says, still, New York is the ideal city of the future because it's a cubist city. She's still excited by its modernity, by its rejection of the past. But probably because artistically she just can't find a niche for herself, she goes back to Paris. And Paris, she finds, is in the grip of a fundamental collapse in faith. People no longer believe in futurism because they can't see a future for themselves. This is the world that has been shattered, imperial myth, the nationalist idols, even the optimism of social Darwinists like Durkheim and many others has been shipwrecked on the rock of the horrors of the Western Front. Futurism comes to an abrupt end. It's replaced by various forms of nihilism, Dada being the most obvious example, or at least explorations of the human essence as being not an ideal, but as the representation of the turbulences of lower egotistic forces in the lower dungeons of the human psyche, surrealism being an expression of that. Freud as the ultimate determiner of the human condition. not some idealistic notion of human becoming, the enlightenment, reasonable man, but as an ultimately selfish and indeed even demonic creature. So she's living in the early 20s in Paris, and the city is now really nihilistic. Lots of tourists, lots of people drinking too much, smoking too much, and essentially the whole idealism seems to have gone out of it. What she remembers, however, is the South. And in 1925, she takes the second of her big, momentous decisions. Having read and studied in Paris, she goes south with the intention of converting to Islam, a path that has been taken by many more before her. You think of Isabel Eberhardt, who's a thousand times better known as a writer than Saint-Point. And she goes to Tangier, and no sooner does she get off the boat and finds herself accommodation that she goes to the imam of the nearest mosque and explains that this is what she wants to do. And she says she's prepared to take on the practices, the fast, the prayer and everything. Because only here, she says, will she genuinely find an authenticity, that authenticity that industrial man has finally lost. And the imam makes a few inquiries, finds out about her rather flamboyantly non-puritanical lifestyle, but nonetheless says, if you're prepared to do it, then let's do it. And she repeats the Shahada, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, several times, each time more faint, until it can't be heard at all, in order to internalize the outward form of the words. And she takes the name Rawhiya Nuruddin. She goes back to Paris, where she no longer participates in the various artistic modes of her time and place, but devotes herself to study, and shortly after takes a boat for Egypt, where she spends the rest of her life. She becomes involved in a magazine. She actually sets up a magazine, partly a surrealist magazine, but also a platform for her particular political and spiritual views. Le Phénix, it's called. All about the rebirth of the Orient as the great alternative to the collapse of the Western, the integrity of the Western consciousness. So she writes things like this. My brothers of the East, I have not come amongst you to support the process of Western civilization. I have come to announce its failure. I accuse Western civilization of having failed in the highest mission to which it was called during the last cycles of world history, which is a sense of the unity of humanity. The despair of the people enslaved to the yoke of industrial overproduction, which creates artificial needs, which is in fact the worst form of slavery, which turns modern citizens into galley slaves, the despair of peoples thus degraded by machinism replies no. The philosophical unbeing replies no. The false materialistic elites claim to give us totality, but ancient spirituality once offered, and Eastern spirituality continue to offer, the road which leads to eternal growth, which leads man to the divine. She becomes very involved in the Egyptian nationalist movement with Saad Zaghloul, who is a kind of hero of her, of hers. She lives in a flat in the fashionable district of Zamalek, surrounded by the reminders of her career, her books, her paintings, her clothes. They're all there. Many of them are still with the family of her secretary, who was a Jewish convert to Islam, whose family is still there. But to her dismay, she sees that the Eastern vision itself is starting to crack and crumble. And this is the kind of thing that cultural critics like Slavoj Žižek will refer to when they say we should not use the term Western, which is a geographical term, which is not very helpful because now what it signifies is everywhere, but instead the monoculture. What is that which is characteristic of the modern thing, the monoculture? The only thing that everybody agrees of it is that in practice it destroys every other culture. That's the only thing that you can unanimously say about it. And in the 1930s in Cairo, that's what's happening. Farouk abdicates in 1936. Egyptian nationalism takes on a very kind of Western nationalistic turn. We want to be Egyptians the way the French are French and the way the English are English. We want a national myth. We want borders. We want a football team. We want a flag. They are buying into the same thing. So she recedes from politics. 1948, the Palestinian Nakba, the disaster of Palestinian refugees, she's not terribly involved in that either, because she sees it as the consequence of the collapse, the abandonment of the traditional political and social and spiritual order, the consequence of the loss of Islamic authenticity. For the last few years of her life, she studies theology. She becomes very poor. She has to sell most of her possessions. And she dies in 1953. And she's buried in the tomb of Imam al-Laythi in Cairo, near Imam al-Shafi'i. A curious career, but one which I've chosen to offer for your consideration as a point of departure for the particular topic which I'm talking about this evening. The issue of gender is something on which there is, despite this term, the monoculture, no consensus whatsoever. What is it to have a morally significant appreciation of the meaning of gender? Does our culture really attribute meaning to anything? Is the feminist, or the frequent feminist reluctance to acknowledge the existence of a female essence and a male essence, simply the consequence of our culture's skepticism about all narratives or all essences? Possibly. But in the case of Valentine, she will not have that. She sees that as being part of modernity's stripping of our authenticity. The whole postmodern turn would seem to her as the final nail in the coffin of true humanism. For her, what is important is a genuine, authentic connection to the integrative reality of the human persona. And she writes about this quite a bit in La Phénix. And during her last year, she writes a book that she doesn't actually complete on métachorie as a practice that integrates body, mind, and spirit, and whose final fulfillment she finds in the Muslim practice of salat, of prayer. The transition, therefore, is really the essence of what we're looking at when we try and figure out what it could be to have one's mind and soul shaped by the monoculture, as all of us have to a greater or lesser extent nowadays, when we look at sacred civilizations where the issue is one of authenticity and of belonging, and where the value systems may appear very lopsided to those of us who are convinced that the monoculture has the final word on what is the good life. What has she found in Cairo? What she has found is the solution to the crisis which Christianity had provoked in late 19th century France. It wasn't just Freud and Darwin who were alerting people to the fundamental quality of la luxure, lust in human relations. Lifestyles were changing. Attitudes to sexuality, traditionally shaped by the church with its preference for a spiritual elite for celibacy, that was crumbling, and Paris was really the world capital in terms of eroticism. How does that lead into the world of Islam, which nowadays, to read the media, is the image of buttoned-up Puritanism? What's the connection? Why could she make that transition? Well, what she's found and what she writes about is that the condition of Europe is a condition of fragmentation. Nobody really knows how to integrate the body with the mind any longer. The very principle of self-knowledge has been more or less abdicated in philosophy. Some philosophers, like Derrida, for instance, when they speak of spirituality, what they mean is the traditional path to knowledge, which assumed that self-knowledge was the point of departure and also the object of philosophy. It was written over the entrance to the Delphic oracle, "Know thyself." Nowadays, particularly when we have a very atomized, fragmented, non-continuous idea of the self and human consciousness, that's something that is very difficult to establish. But all traditional cultures assumed that that was the basis of knowledge and therefore of happiness. For her, happiness means to integrate the different disparate aspects of the personality. The mind, the body, and the spirit have to be in harmony and have to be celebrated together. She continues, as a Muslim, as Rawhiya Nur al-Din, to be a person who believes in celebration. This is not a puritanical vision, but it's a celebration that affirms that you don't have a time when you're partying, and a time when you're drunk, and a time when you're in the laboratory, and a time when you're getting married, but all of it has to come together in a single integrated view of the human condition. The more we're fragmented, the more uneasy we will be, the more we will be susceptible to depression, to stress. And those were the characteristic features of her age. So that's the journey that she takes. And that's the point, the point d'appui, if you like, that I'm going to adopt in this. Islam really as a reaction against, and for people like Valentine, perceived as the solution to the fragmentation of the human persona imposed by Christianity. To know God, be an ethereal being, and renounce sexuality. Look at Peter Brown's books on the body and society, and you'll see how really uniquely amongst the major world religions, Christianity has launched a war on the flesh and has associated Eros with the demonic. Adam sinned, there is original sin, reproduction becomes necessary because we are now mortal. So if you're virginal, as the Church Fathers recognized, and to this day it's really part of the Vatican's teaching on sexuality, look at Lucien Lacan's book, The Biblical Doctrine of Virginity, to anticipate the life of the blessed, which of course is non-sexual, and to recover the paradisal state of innocence of Adam and Eve, you have to be asexual. That is axiomatic for them, certainly axiomatic in pre-conciliar 19th century French Catholicism. That's what she's reacting against. And if we look at the larger historical picture, we can see that this is what Islam is reacting against as well. When we want to start generalizing about Islam's understanding of sexuality, we have to see it in its original context of a polemic. Islam as a prophetic, as she would see it, revolutionary moment in history, is a polemic against the Christian war on the body. And the most common theme in Christian polemic against Islam until very recently was that Islam valorizes sexuality and therefore can't be legitimate. And even, horror of horrors, it seems to have some erotic component in its idea of paradise, which for people like Aquinas, Peter the Venerable, the medieval Christian writers on Islam, automatically disqualified it. If there's going to be sex in heaven, then that's a silly religion. Islam seems to come as an argument against that, and I think it's helpful to understand its temper and its take on sexuality when you recognize that original polemical motif. It is coming at a particular point in monotheistic history where Judaism has been, at least demographically, outstripped by the New Covenant, by Christianity, whose absolute focus is on renouncing and mortifying the flesh, separating out body from spirit. Liberate yourself from the cage of the body, and then you'll be truly yourself, hence the monastic and priestly traditions. So we can say, as our first cautious generalization, that Islam's take on sexuality and gender sexuality, you can never speak about in isolation from each other, is part of a polemic against Christianity, and particularly against the characteristic recurrent Christian war on the flesh. Now, this is part of a larger 19th century, early 20th century European romantic sense of the South, the sunlit lands, the exotic East, as the place where there is sexual plenitude and human wholeness. And, well, you think of Gide going to Biskra and Flaubert going to Upper Egypt and all kinds of odd people going to Tangiers. That's where you wanted to go if you were the anticipation of what in the 60s would be called the beatniks. Oscar Wilde goes to Algiers. It's not just a heterosexual alternative. And there are moments in European Enlightenment literature where that actually comes to the surface, and where Islam and the prophet of Islam are figured, are platformed as ideals which should be aspired to as the alternative to the mechanistic narrative of a still anti-sexual or sexually chaotic, unregulated Europe. Goethe is the best-known example, but others could be cited. Rilke would be an example with his poems on the prophet, and various others. And I brought along a translation of Goethe's Mahometsgesang, Schubert, turned it into two songs. This is 1770 something. Let all come then, and now swells he lordlier still, yea, e'en a people bears his regal flood on high, and in triumph onward rolling names to countries gives he, cities spring to light beneath his foot. Ever, ever on he rushes, leaves the tower's flame-tipped summit, marble palaces, the offspring of his fullness far behind. Cedar houses bears the Atlas on his giant shoulders, fluttering in the breeze far, far above him, thousand flags are gaily floating, bearing witness to his might. And so beareth he his brethren, all his treasures, all his children, wildly shouting to the bosom of his long expectant father. Well, a lot of Muslims would say that sounds very weird as a kind of nod, but that's Goethe's Mahometsgesang, that the 18th century dawning of a realization that perhaps in the East there's an alternative to this industrialized but sexually puritanical culture that seems to be producing a stressful and an inauthentic human persona. Valentine is an extension of that. And as I mentioned, other examples. You could look perhaps at some of the paintings of Matisse, for instance, the window in Tangiers and the plump naked ladies. There's a kind of connection between the two. Now, that's the context. Two alternatives. Islam and Christianity, obviously cognate religions, overlapping religions in many respects. But on this fundamental issue, sexuality, and therefore the take on gender, there's going to be a very substantial difference. And I already mentioned how the favorite polemic for medieval European priests arguing against Islam was that it was the religion of sexual indulgence. That's why they thought that Muslims worship on Friday, because it was the pagan day of Venus. So why else would it be the Muslim Yom al-Jumu'ah, the day of Friday? A recurrent polemic. If we take that theologically and look at the Qur'an as Muslims as a divine rectification of a religious story that has gone tragically wrong, that is, through this fragmentation of body and soul, causing immense human suffering and spiritual inauthenticity, we are going to expect to find in this story a valorization of Eros. And you can say it's already there. It's in Judaism, which valorizes sexuality just as much as Islam does, and that's one of the few things that you're not just allowed to do, but supposed to do on the Sabbath if you're a rabbinical Jew. That's true. That's very true. And in fact, you could point out that in most traditional religions, there is a generally positive attitude to Eros, and even in some traditions, particularly in the subcontinent, a tradition of using erotic metaphors as a metaphor for the union with the divine. It's only in Christianity, classical Christianity, that's very unusual. But nonetheless, that's one of the themes of the Qur'an, and that, I think, is one of the explanations for the Qur'an's explicit and repeated eroticization of paradise, which, of course, feeds into the rich mystical tradition. If the purpose of the Sufi is to live in his life a life of perfection, then the life of the blessed in paradise must be a kind of sign of what that perception would be like, which is the exact reciprocal of the Christian idea. The life of the blessed in paradise is virginal, therefore we should be virginal. No marriage, no giving in marriage in heaven, says St. Paul, therefore that's the ideal. That's the saved state. For Muslims, because Eros is paradisal, and paradise is seen as the kind of pure area of archetypes of the things that exist only imperfectly in this world, therefore part of the devotional life is going to be erotic in Islam. Of course, it's a huge, diverse, chaotic, unregulated civilization. There's no papacy to say what's right and what's wrong, and you will find celibates, just as you will find vegetarians, and just as you will find all kinds of eccentrics on the fringes of different Islamic movements. But by and large, a characteristic feature of Islamic spirituality, when compared to classical Christian spirituality, is that it's a bit disappointing if the saint is unmarried. Look at somebody like Ibn Ajiba, 200 years ago in Morocco, one of the greatest saints of North Africa, still a household name though. One of the processes of purgation which his teacher put him through was that he had to live next to the city's dunghills, and that he had to beg in the streets in order to break his ego. If you read the biography, you'll find during that period he married two wives, which if you compare it to the lives of the saints in a Christian context, doesn't compute at all. But for the Muslim way of looking at things, that's not a problem, because as Nawawi says, one of the great medieval Muslim jurists, all desires harden the heart with the exception of sexual desire, which softens it. All desires harden the heart with the exception of sexual desire, which softens it. So just as there is a final archetype in paradise, which is the anticipation of human fullness, and which must include Eros, so also in the founding story of the religion, there must also be the valorization of Eros, which is what we get in the early story of Islam. Look, for instance, at the Prophet in his night devotions. And Aisha, radiallahu anha, has conserved for us the memory of this. You get up in the middle of the night and pray for hours, and his legs would swell because he'd been standing for so long. And those are the famous dialogues that are recorded. But remember, she's with him. His teenage wife is with him while he's getting up to do his devotions. Very different from the Christian idea of the time of the hermit or the anchorite alone worshipping in his cell. Very different. So we look at the story of the Prophet as believers as an iconic representation of the new order, which is going to include this aspect of the human composite, human fulfillment, which had been lost sight of by not so much early Christianity, but Christianity as it had evolved by that time. Here, the tradition encounters a difficulty. If you look at the medieval Muslims who have meditated on the Prophet's marriages, you will find them saying a range of things. Obvious things such as, this is the way of the Prophets, Jacob, Moses, Abraham, Solomon. Marital plenitude is part of what it is, part of the magnificence of patriarchy. Patriarchy with a big P, if you like. That's the obvious thing that they say. It's a continuation of the prophetic vocation. But then they say, one of the characteristics of our religion, Milletina, is that we have this idea of the Sunnah. He is to be exemplary. And as far as we can tell, rabbinic Judaism, for instance, has never really had that conception regarding Moses. You follow the law, you follow the Torah, you love the law, you love the Torah, but it's not quite a question of finding out how Moses cleaned his teeth and which side he got out of bed in the morning. And there isn't a sunnah of Moses that is really central to, say, Talmudic reflection on how to be a good Jew. Islam does have this particular quality, which is that its ideal is not abstracted, but is represented in a human being. And this, for somebody like Valentine, is particularly attractive. And some of the things she wrote towards the end of her life are devotional writings about the Prophet as al-insan al-kamil, the perfect human being. Here you have an example of a human being who is integrated between heaven and earth, who discharges his political responsibilities, but who also has family responsibilities as well, who is fully amongst his people and particularly living the life of the poor of his people. The ascetic, who is nonetheless a member of society rather than the anchorite outside the city gates. For her, a particularly attractive model of sainthood. But the problem is, if you are going to have this idea of sunnah, and every Muslim subsequently is going to define human perfection in terms of getting as close as possible to that, you have actually two problems. First of all, what if you're a woman? Here's a man. Secondly, what does that mean about the kind of woman that a man should choose? The Prophet marries a tall woman. Every saint, every scholar is going to want to marry a tall woman. What happens to the short girls? It's a real issue. The Prophet marries a widow. Everybody wants to marry a widow. What happens to all of the virgins? The Prophet marries from his own tribe. What happens to the people who are from outside the tribe? And so people like Shatibi and others will reflect on this and will say, this is part of the hikmah, part of the divine wisdom, in which the Prophet's are given a plurality of wives. That's the way in which they see things. Modern scholars would want to add to that by saying that as well as necessarily representing that there can be a perfection of female types, there is also a political dimension that can never be separated from the prophet's career because it's a thoroughly political story as well as what in the West would be called a religious story. So what I want to do now, and I've got a few more minutes, I hope, is to go through some of the wives. And remember that the religion already in the Qur'an and some of the hadith has set up its ideals of perfection. And it does not say there is a single model of female perfection. كَمُلَ مِنَ النِّسَاءِ أَرْبَعَ. Four women have become perfect, according to her hadith. Again, contrast with Christianity, who is the perfect woman? The Virgin Mary. St. Ambrose says, alone of all her sex, she pleased the Lord. In Islam, she's one of those four perfect women, but there are others as well. And the hadith go on to explain the significance of this. One of the women is the Virgin Mary, who becomes the example of the detached worshipper. That's what she does, worshipping in the temple. And the one who is vindicated when she is slandered. The patriarchs slander her, she turns out to be vindicated by God. If you're coming to this evening's lecture, I'll talk about that in more detail then. But there are other figures. Khadija, who is Khadija? Khadija bint Khuwailid, we know that she was his first wife, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Establishes some interesting precedents. She's 40, he's 25. She makes the approach. She's the one with the money, and he becomes her employee. From that time on, and modern apologetics in particular will focus on this, it never becomes quite possible to say that women can't be employers, women can't run businesses, women can't be older than their husbands. Three classic patriarchal assumptions, because that's the woman that was married to the Holy Prophet before all of the others. That's important as the kind of elder woman, and also as the mother, because one of the things about the seerah, about the Prophet's biography, that are less easy to understand and to interpret is that he has, some will say 11 wives, some will say 13, there's actually no consensus on how many it was, that he only has four daughters and two or three sons. What does that mean? We don't really know, but the four daughters are the ones who we know about and celebrate, and the sons die when they're just babies. All four daughters come from Khadija. Another thing that they say, don't despair if you are given daughter after daughter after daughter, because you've got a good precedent for that. Characteristic feature of pre-modern cultures is that people prefer sons over daughters. That's why when you legalize scans in Indian hospitals, immediately 90% of the abortions are carried out on female fetuses. In many cultures, there is a prejudice. And he says anybody who is given three daughters and brings them up well and educates them will be resurrected on the Day of Judgment as close to me as that. There are specific hadith that say, don't worry about having daughters. So even in his daughters, never mind his wife, we have this interesting phenomenon. Inna shani akahul abtar, one of the first criticisms made of him by the pagan patriarchs in Mecca, is that he's abtar. He has no progeny, he's only got daughters. But the Ahlul Bayt, the most respected family in all human history, come through Fatima, not through his son. In the classic ancient monarchic ideas, it would have to be a son, but through Fatima. Fatima to Zahra, radiallahu anha. Also, in terms of the ancient and the early medieval world, an unusual kind of thing. So we go through the wives, and we see that there are these ideal types that are in the Qur'an, and I should have mentioned also Asiya bint Muzahim, who's not a biblical character, but is indicated in the Qur'an and is fleshed out a little bit in the hadith. She is the believing wife of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. And the hadith says, if a wife is maltreated by her husband, God will give her the reward that was given to Asiya, wife of Pharaoh. So she's the model of the maltreated, beaten bride. In terms of his own wives, what do we find? And one of the best treatments of this is in Montgomery Watt's book, Muhammad at Medina, which came out, published Oxford University Press in the early 50s. Montgomery Watt's preoccupation is with trying to figure out why he married these women in terms of the political and tribal context. So he gives a list of the political alliances that were made. But he also points out that some of them were clearly done for humanitarian reasons. In that world, one of the honorable things that a man could do would be to take into his household a widow or a divorced woman, a woman who otherwise would be out on the streets. So you could say that there's two categories in which the prophet's wives fall. There are the mercy marriages and there are the peace marriages. Let's propose that as a basic criterion. There are those who he marries out of mercy, and there are those who he marries in order to cement an alliance with a tribe with whom there would otherwise be a conflict. Remember the big picture, and Montgomery Watt's later book is Muhammad, Prophet and Statesman. This is a great political achievement. To unite Arabia, which nobody has united before ever, a land of warring factions and tribes, a land of pagans, difficult people, to unite them in 23 years so successfully that that unity survives his demise, one of the great political success stories in history. Montgomery Watt points out, as he goes through the list of the Ummahat al-Mu'mineen, the mothers of the believers, the prophet's wives, is that each one of these wives, he says, was involved in a political marriage. That's his interpretation. So he says, you can find it. It is not too much to say that all Muhammad's marriages had a political aspect. He did not enter into marriages except when they were politically and socially desirable. That's his explanation of the otherwise extraordinary success of the seerah. He starts out as a rejected preacher in the city of Mecca. His own people chuck him out. Within 23 years, he's the ruler of Arabia and he's united his people. Strategic marriages, which were part and parcel of the ancient world, were very much part of that. So, for instance, he marries into the families of his closest associates, and you think particularly of Hafsa, who's a widow. Her husband has been killed at the Battle of Badr. She is the daughter of Omar. So by marrying the daughter of Umar ibn Khattab, who becomes the second Khalifa, he has already established a political nucleus. Similarly, the other wife of one of the companions is daughter of one of the companions is Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr. So his two closest associates, he cemented that connection by marrying their daughters. Aisha was the only one of his wives who had not been previously married. The others were widows. Other examples, Juwayriya bint al-Harith. She was the daughter of the chief of the Bani al-Mustaliq, one of the factions of the tribe of Khuza'a, who were constantly raiding and in a feuding situation with the early Muslim state in Medina. By cementing that union, Khuza'a then became allies. Habiba is the daughter of Abu Sufyan, who is who? His arch-enemy in the city of Mecca. And he marries her in 628 on his return from Khaybar. She's in her mid or late 30s. And she has already been married to Ubaidullah bin Jahsh, radiallahu anhu, who had made hijrah to Abyssinia with her. He dies, and the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam marries her, thereby marrying into the family of the idolatrous elite in the city of Mecca, an event that's then going to have very momentous consequences. Maymuna bint al-Harith, in her late 20s, she is one of those who presented themselves to the Prophet for marriage. And again, in the category of political marriages, her brother-in-law was the Prophet's uncle, Al-Abbas. So again, he's cementing in Montgomery Watt's view a key connection with one of the elite families in Mecca. Safiya bint Huyay is Jewish but converts to Islam and is the daughter of the leader of one of the big Jewish tribes, which is to show, according to the chroniclers, not only that he's now going to be in a politically positive relationship with that tribe, but also that it's possible to marry outside a particular Arabian context. There's nothing wrong with marrying a Gentile. There's going to be no Arab prejudice. That's another important precedent. Sauda bin Zama shows many things. She's in her 40s. She's a widow of Sakran bin Amr. She's also been on the hijrah to Abyssinia and returned. Her brother was one of the most important pagans in Mecca. And they were also from the Bani Muttalib, so quite close to the Prophet's family. And she's regarded as being an example of how it's permissible to marry people whose skins are darker than your own, because she was black. And therefore that becomes an important precedent in Sharia. There's no obstacle to doing that. Other examples, Salama, one of the best known of the hadith transmitters amongst the Prophet's wives. She's from the Makhzum clan. He also needs to win them over. She's a widow. She already has many children. So you can say that this is an example of both. It's a mercy marriage because she's a widow, she's got lots of children, but also a political marriage because she's very close to the leaders of Makhzum, who are one of the dominant tribes in Mecca. And once Mecca has fallen and the Muslim rule has been established there, these strategic marriages become hugely important in winning over the chieftains of Quraysh to the new religion. Other examples could be cited. Zainab bin Jahsh is a case that's famous because it's often misunderstood. She's aged 38. There are arguments, but probably that's her age. You have to remember, in those times and before air conditioning, to be aged 38 then probably meant that you looked quite a bit older. And this, his marriage to her is the famous occasion of a revelation of the Quranic text. She is a widow. She comes to Medina. She is asked to marry Zayd bin Haritha, who is the adopted son of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The famous incident is that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam goes to Zayd's house. He is not there. She comes out, and he sees her, and he says, "Subhanallah, mughayyir al-qulub. Praise be to God, manager of hearts." Zayd hears about this. He's not happy with her. She's not happy with him. Zayd goes and offers to the Prophet, offers to divorce her. And the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, no. Zainab then goes, saying that it's now really impossible for me to live with Zayd. And the divorce takes place. The waiting period is completed. And then she marries the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which is justified by revelation in the Quranic text itself. This also has political ramifications, in that he's now allied to the Meccan clan of Abd Shams. Abu Sufyan's daughter Habiba had become Muslim, and she was married to Zainab's brother. So there was another connection being established with the Meccan elite. None of his wives are from Medina. Why is that? He's living in Medina. That's where these marriages are taking place. Probably because it was necessary for him not to generate any partiality or rivalry amongst the tribes who are actually located in Medina. He's reaching out to the other tribes in the manner of a traditional Arabian chieftain, creating strategic marriages in order to win them over. Perhaps at this point, and people are likely making signs at me, I should shut up. I've covered a lot of territory. I hope at least I've given you some sense of the way I'm thinking about this issue. The status of Islam is specifically a reaction against traditional Christian problematization of the body and sexuality. The idea that Islam has not a single idea of feminine perfection, but has four that are specified in the hadith, and a number of them who marry the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, thereby meaning that the sunnah is not to marry one particular sort of woman, which would generate huge practical problems for Muslim piety subsequently, but that there's a whole range of women. You can marry men older than yourself, younger than yourself. They can be white, they can be black, they can be virgins, they can be widowed, they can be, there's a huge range, they can be non-Arab. All of that is validated. And then finally, the point that I'm drawing from Montgomery Watt's book, which is that we can categorize these into two categories. The mercy marriages, the ones that are done for reasons of social security to take the needy into the family, and also the political marriages, which actually, for Montgomery Watt, represent one of the most successful dimensions of the prophet's diplomacy and a partial explanation for his eventual political success in Arabia. Anyway, essentially that's what I wanted to talk about. There's a few other things that one could mention regarding Islam's theology of gender, the gendering of God, the nature of gender in Revelation, things like that. But I think I'll have to shut up at this point. And I believe there are going to be questions. Yep.